Why do they think they can fool us?
I'm Dave. Hello, everybody. This is Again with This, episode 54. Let's watch March Across on CSI Original Ray's Mothership Vegas version. And now here are your hosts, Tara Ariano and Sarah D. Bunting.
We are back again with this.
Again.
Again with this. Thank you so much for your support, Patreon supporters. We hope you will enjoy this episode that is just for y'all. As you've probably guessed, we are talking about a CSI episode, specifically season 2, episode 11. It's called Organ Grinder. Perhaps, like me, you thought that maybe this was one of the multiple porphyria-based episodes involving kidneys and milkshakes, but it is not. An otherwise healthy philanderer strokes out in an elevator, and his grieving widow, Julia Fairmont, played by Marcia Cross, is a little too Janey on the spot about donating his organs, then having him cremated. Of course, it's still the second act of the episode by the time the CSIs are raising their eyebrows about this, so we'll have to get through a good half hour of 1. Unnecessary exposition among science professionals about their own sciencing and professionaling and shorthands for same. And 2, frankly off-putting anecdotal evidence collection from one Gil Grissom. Dave, could you please play clip 2? You
smell the musk? A hint of bleach? Sexual intercourse?
He's not wrong.
I know it's the wrong show. You don't have to tell me.
Yes.
He's not wrong, but the pronunciation of intercourse,
yes.
No. Let us move on with alacrity. Through some intramural crush stuff involving Grego and Sarah Seidel. Before the episode lets its side eye fall upon another suspect, the deceased's over-invested assistant, Claudia, a.k.a. Helen Haley from A League of Their Own, and her telltale dandruff. Marcia Cross is more than happy to let suspicion fall on Claudia when Catherine draws a line between Claudia's dandruff shampoo and the dead man's favorite cream cheese. Must be Thursday. But the sniping between Julie and Claudia that ensues may mean more than meets the eye. Clip 3, please.
Aren't you going to arrest her?
I haven't done anything.
Other than poison Bob.
Poison? I'm the one who looked out for him.
You? I ran his home. I entertained his clients.
Who made all of his dental appointments, huh? His haircuts. Who got his taxes in on time?
Who covered for his mistresses?
Why did he need mistresses?
Ladies, don't go there.
Brass.
I included that bit from Brass because it occurred to me while I was prepping this episode, my husband, who cannot get away with phrases like cray cray, because no one can anymore, still occasionally busts out these things that are like Real Housewives vintage 2011. And I'm like, really? Dan, man born in the 1960s with the "you go girl" that you just dropped on one of the cats. But that line delivery from Brass just reminded me of Dan and of the fact that Dan really needs to get a recurring role on SVU so that neither of us has to work anymore. But yeah. Anyway, back to the episode in which there follows performative Boolean search stringing on the World Wide Web machine by Greg. An exhumation that looks like it's occurring on an unused hole of holy moly. And a whole lot of unnecessarily squelchy Foley design as a 3 years dead dude's liver goes into literally a Hamilton Beach blender. This deposits us at a Strangers on a Train-esque sort of scenario that, because it's 2001 and is on CBS, can't quite bring itself to make the subtext text, namely that these two ladies are a couple. At least they should be. Claudia killed her rich husband years ago, got busted by Julia, who was her husband's assistant, got blackmailed by Julia into splitting the inheritance, and when they ran through the money faster than they'd expected, and a question mark, sort of unclear, but that's Catherine's theory, together they decided to flip the script on another young Forbes lister in another town. Alas, and a question mark, they get away with it, at least as far as we see, and neither actor ever returned to the show, spoiler, so that's how it goes sometimes. Fairly typical CSI episode, at least from the early days, I would say. The Sarah Gill stuff isn't too annoying, Brass is funny-ish, etc. and so on, but I am interested to hear from the rewatchers on our panel today about how they felt about this episode in context, and then specifically how they thought Marcia Cross did.
Well, Texans. Yes, I actually paused our rewatch before we got to this episode because I knew we were going to be talking about it. So we watched it this weekend. I like the episodes better where it's just one case because inevitably one case is interesting and one case is kind of boring, or one case is more about the people and one case is more about like the wonkiness. But this was more fun because it was all just this one story. And it is legitimately twisty. I mean, I had forgotten what the twist was, that they were like in league together and that they pulled this before, which is like, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's not bad.
It is good.
And, you know, you believe that either of them could have done it when you don't know what the twist is. And so it does effectively like keep you guessing as it goes through. Anne Elizabeth Ramsey, who plays Claudia, she is Helen Haley from A League of Their Own, but she's also Lisa from Mad About You, Jamie's sister.
Yes.
I felt bad that she had to be the one with dandruff because she does have great hair.
It's true. She really does, no matter the era.
Yeah. She's one of my faves. I like her a lot. So it was fun to see her with Marcia Cross, who was, of course, incredible. Like, this is definitely in her, like, cashmere sweater and wool pants era. Like, every outfit, you're like, of course that's what she's wearing. Like, she's definitely styled to look like a rich real estate developer's wife in Las Vegas, even though she's probably hot as hell. But
yeah,
she, this was also her Two Stars, One Slot with Brenda Strong era, like for sure.
Absolutely.
Brenda Strong had already been in an episode. I forget if it was this season or the season before, but we'd already seen her as the shrink who did the rebirthing ceremony and killed a kid.
Sure.
That was her.
Yep.
And yeah, you're right that the Gil Sarah stuff isn't that annoying because it didn't ramp up until a few episodes after this, where they have that line at the hockey rink where she's like, "When did you start caring about beauty?" And he says, "When I met you." And it's like, oh no,
oh,
she
God.
Is one of my least favorite characters. Like, I don't like her any better going this time through. She's such a teacher's pet. She's so irritating and like,
oh my God, yeah.
The bitch face all the time. I know it's not her fault, but let's like, it's just the one more face, just one more expression is all I ask. What, a micro expression, something.
Yeah. And then her line deliveries are just like the locutions, like
that's
for some reason. My brother is a huge Gil Grissom fan, but like they, I think, bailed on the show because of her. And one time he wandered into, we used to live in the same building, listeners. And he like wandered into my apartment while I was watching an old ER with Georgia Fox on it and like ran, like performatively ran out of the room and like into the street. And like I look out my front window and he's like sobbing, and then he looks and he's like, "I'm doing a bit." I'm like, I got it. There's a car. And he's like, "How can you stand her?" I was like, "She was really appealing on ER. And that let me coast with Sarah Seidel being super annoying for a long time." But eventually it ended. Another thing that I was sort of having trouble with for a couple of minutes at the top of the episode is that on Hulu, which is where we watched the episode, and there will be a link in the show notes, they're advertising it with the last cast. So it's like Ted Danson and Elizabeth Shue. And like, I watched those episodes and they were good. They're fine. They were better. They're better than Fishburne era, I felt. But it's still really disconcerting, especially since we are in the middle of a Cheers rewatch in which Sam has started to really bum us out with how sexually harassy he is.
Yeah.
And then there's old Ted and his glasses looking very serious, and Andrew's sister.
Yeah.
Looking nothing like him. Thank God for that.
One quirk of our Apple TV is that it will switch from that. We won't know until the episode has started, but it, because of the way Apple TV works, and sorry to bore people who have it, but like, it will keep track of all your apps, except for Netflix. And if you're watching a series, it has like a little sort of like tray. And so if you have another episode of whatever you're watching, it'll be in the tray and you can just click it instead of having to go to the whatever app it is.
Right.
It's like a dashboard, I guess, is a better way to put it. But sometimes the dashboard will just decide we want to watch CSI en Español. So that's the one where, like, the episode will start, and sometimes it'll just be like indistinct noises. So you don't necessarily know if this is supposed to be dialogue that you understand or if it's just like noises or if these are just Spanish speaking characters on the show until like one of the actual cast members shows up and it's like, okay, Gil doesn't speak Spanish, so this is probably wrong. Let's back this up.
It's like, why does everyone, including the women, sound like Buzz Lightyear at the end of Toy Story 3? This is upsetting.
Yes. So that one is illustrated with Gil and Catherine. And that's how we know something has gone amiss. It's like, oh no, we're still watching in English, but thank you for trying to broaden our horizons.
I mean, maybe they're like, well, they're in Texas.
True.
That's what I love about Texas.
It could be.
There are a couple of great moments. I think Marsha Cross's best acting is in the little, like, not flashbacks, but like blip for theorizing bits that they have on CSI.
Yes.
There's one in particular where there's like a side crime that Gary Dordan's character, whose name I forgot for some reason.
Warwick Brown.
Yes, Warwick. Oh, alas, poor Warwick. Sorry. Had to be done. Warwick had fucked something up, which he admits on screen, and he's not really in this episode that much, which is a shame, because I enjoy looking at Warwick. But the current deceased got shot in the Johnson and said it was an accident. He was cleaning his gun. And there's a very hilarious reenactment video of it just looks like Lego people. And then there's the wound track. But there's also a blip for theory bit of her just like with one leg dangling over the side of a chair, leveling a gun at this guy's Johnson. And that will be our lead art for this episode because, obviously, but she just looks so Kimberly and like she's having a great time. But the rest of the episode is like, ironically, it points up how good she is because she, it's not that she's phoning it in or bad, obviously, just that this kind of role requires one gear from her and she never has to get out of it until she's pointing a gun and raising one of those perfect eyebrows, which gotta love it.
Yeah. This was a fun one. I was glad that you picked it because there's her performance, as you said, is great. And when they give her enough like little character notes to make her compelling even before you know what the true story is. Like, you know, he knows that he cheats on her with women who look like her, but younger. It's like, oh, wow. That's a good detail. That's very smart. But
especially in this episode where this show's lighting is not forgiving.
Oh, no.
It never was, like, even before everyone had like HD 7K or whatever. Like, she looks perfect. Flawless.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this isn't that much longer after her time on Melrose. It's like, you know, within 5 years, I think. I can't remember this.
Meanwhile, she had the same flawless complexion even on an SVU that was like 10 years after this episode that we watched. So,
Yeah, she's stunning.
Bless her heart.
Yeah. Yep. someone must have watched this and thought, we got to get her on another show. And a few short years later, Desperate Housewives came along.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, this is Again With This, episode 48, Let's Watch Doug Savant in Masquerade. And now here are your hosts, Tara Ariano and Sarah D. Bunting.
Hello, Sarah and Dave.
Hello.
Hello, listeners. Hello, Rob Lowe's butt. Thank you for joining us today. We are going to be talking about Masquerade. And here's the story of how this came to be a topic. We've mentioned Listen to Sassy on a Patreon episodes before. This is the podcast that Dave and I do with our friend Pamela Ribbon about Sassy magazine. And in the June 1988 issue, there's an article about what happens when you, the reader, get turned on sexually, and it cites as an example of something that might do it to you the sex scene in the Rob Lowe movie Masquerade, which I'd never heard of until this article. Did I look up
that
sex scene?
Saw it in the theater. Not sure how that was allowed to happen.
Well, whew. Yeah. The sex scene is also available online if you want to just watch that. But when I was plugging our episode on that issue later that week, looking for photos, what did I happen to see in that Google search but sweet little baby Doug Savant grabbing Rob Lowe by the hair in one of them?
Mm-hmm.
And this shit was on HBO Max. Duh, obviously, we're going to make it an Again With This. At the earliest possible opportunity, which this is, it's my turn to program the next four Again With This has just came up. Here we are. So, Masquerade.
She was offered the chance to cut this in line, too.
Oh, I could wait. Masquerade came out March 13th, 1988. It was directed by Bob Swaim, who is American, but seems to have mostly worked in France. And it was written by Sarah.
Dick Wolf.
It was written by motherfucking Dick Wolf.
And it really, I don't know, like in my notes, I kept coming back to that. I was just like, oh my God, like that. Well, we'll get into it. But yeah. I mean, Dick Wolf.
Dick.
Chung and Chung.
Dick the Wolf. I was watching at my desk so I could take notes. I just about fell out of my chair when his credit came up. Because it comes up first as like a producer. I was like, oh, he produced it. And then I was like, he fucking wrote it. Anyway, he also has a cameo pretty early on. Our boy Doug Savant is fourth billed. Pretty good. I was proud of him. So this is a very twisty noir story. It's totally fun. You should watch it, but we're about to spoil the hell out of it. So if you think you're going to want to, and you do,
just really save this
episode. Come back to it after you've watched the movie. I went into it with very low expectations. I was honestly shocked by how much it just tickled me.
It really, I mean, I remembered nothing about it except a couple of people who were in it, not including Doug Savant. I certainly did not remember Dick Wolf wrote it. I remembered like the basic premise, but like once we were up to like a sextuple cross, literally, I was like, I didn't remember that at all. It's an hour and 31 minutes.
Yep.
And it's like, there are a couple of crosses that you're like, wait, like you have the luxury of pausing it and going back to Sixth Sense it for yourself and be like, wait, but is that still going to hold up?
Right.
And it does.
It does.
Like, this is an extremely well-constructed, like it's fairly trashy, but also has a real ear for the way rich people are horrible and weird in ways that we don't really understand.
Mm-hmm.
And it kept surprising me with stuff. And there were also just boobs and butts.
Boobs and butts.
And beautiful real estate.
Yep.
Like boobs, butts, Bridgehampton, what's not to like?
Yes. So the short version of the plot is basically Meg Tilly plays Olivia, a recently orphaned heiress of $200 million. Rob Lowe plays Tim, a yacht skipper for hire who's ended up in the Hamptons for the summer. They meet by chance, or do they, at some ball or something and hit it off. But can she trust his motives, or is he just after her money? So first, Tim's boss's wife is played by Kim Cattrall. She's third billed. And obviously they are fucking, clip one.
You want your birthday present, don't you?
You remembered. It's more than my husband did.
They're black lacy underpants.
Barely. It's like a stamp.
You want me to put these on?
I can't bite them off if you don't.
He sells it. God fucking help me. He sells it.
He does.
I will also say she's very seldom wearing clothes, but in the scene prior to this, she's wearing this pearl studded white elbow length sweater situation that I was like, I don't know how again with this turned into source sweaters for Sarah Hour, but I'm not mad. And if anyone knows where I, who, or has a line on a vintage one of those, let me know.
Yeah, it's cute.
Unfortunately, at the time I was dressing exactly like Olivia, a lot of sleeveless sweaters and midi skirts with pockets.
This is also the first scene where we see Rob Lowe's butt. Mm-hmm. Less than 6 minutes in, which, correct, that timing is correct.
Know your demo.
Yeah, his butt might as well be fifth billed, frankly. But her boobs are also in the scene very much. And she, I think she brings a lot to this very cliched role of like the bored, sexually unsatisfied wife of a rich guy.
Yeah, she was in a lot of pretty garbagey stuff around this time. I, for some reason, have seen, the reason is I had a crush on Timothy Hutton. I am so sorry to everyone.
We didn't know.
This is why I saw Turk 182 like 188 times. She's in that. She has the stupidest, goofiest role. And the idea that she, even in character, would be attracted to this 114-pound scrawn in the form of Hutton is insane. But she almost sells it. She is pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. She's a good actor.
I think nobody remembers that because like Samantha has just flashed out everything.
Absolutely. So we meet, her name is Brooke. We meet her before we meet Olivia, which feels like not an accident. Like, obviously I've already gone all the way on the record with my love for this picture, but one problem with it is Meg Tilly as Olivia and or the writing of this character, because she's such a drip.
She, I refer to her in various different ways in my notes. Simpering sinus girl, Simpy McSniffles. there's usually something with Simpy. There's also the feeling that you start to get about 45 minutes in that every other character is absolutely dying to append the phrase, you dumbass, to every interaction with Ms. McSniffle. I'm very happy. You are? You dumbass. there is something about her, like, sinusy up in her sinus delivery that, like, you know, at this time, we forget that this was the Tilly to bet. Like, if you're going to bet a Tilly, like, which Tilly will be famous in 2021 still?
Yeah, she was in The Big Chill. She was in Agnes of God with Anne Bancroft. Like,
yeah, oh, God. And she was just as simpy in that. And I had to study that one for a scene thing in drama class. Oh, God.
Yeah, part of what makes the next phase of the plot work is that Olivia is supposed to seem and be very innocent, but she kind of just plays her like a baby. You know, her first scene is her graduating college. You know, presumably she's had some kind of life experience, but maybe not.
Well, and it also just seems, I mean, I think it's smart of the screenplay to leave certain things. Like, you never really get an explanation, like when it's like, oh, I'll tell them your life story, the real one. Like the stepfather trying to sort of like prophylactically blackmail Rob Lowe.
Yeah.
And that he's played by John Glover and he is extremely convincingly DuPont-y and gross.
Oh, we'll get to him.
Oh, yeah. But there are a number of Bear agrees that the movie is excellent. There are a number of things that are never explained or sort of gone back to that I really respected that they didn't do like a flashback that it's like, here's what happened, or like, here they are talking before the season began. Like, thank you for just trusting that this plot holds. Mm-hmm. And when I paused it and went back over my notes and was like, wait, is that still going to work? It usually did. Mm-hmm. So, I wish there had been a little bit more, like maybe a line or a line and a half about like her parents, like a strict Catholic upbringing or something. Like there's a couple of implications that she is just like, has been very cloistered and probably went to, probably had single sex education the whole time, but then her parents seemed rather louche. So I don't really know what was going on. I also kept thinking we were going to find out that her mom's death was.
That Tony related. Killed her. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Or related somehow that like the cop killed her, that she.
Something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Speaking of the cop, Olivia's old boyfriend, Mike McGill, is played by our boy, DS, Doug Savant. He was studying law, but he's taken a job as a local cop in this town, and he and Olivia sure are still on friendly terms. And she's like just a summer person. He's a townie. And they dated when they were both teens. He's so cute. So cute.
I mean, the uniform looks great. And then he hooks on those aviator glasses. And I was like, ugh. God damn you, propaganda.
I know. The other thing is like that I never really noticed when we watch our, you know, Melrose, because it's such a shitty transfer, but on beautiful HBO Max on my TV, you could see all like his little summery freckles, like adorable. Anyway,
and also he's wearing clothing that fits.
He is. Yep. So he's presented as Olivia's chumpy ex, who's maybe still carrying a torch, but is generally happy just to be around her. And since we've seen Doug Savant playing a good-natured chump kind of a lot, this feels very comfortable. Clip two.
What are you going to do?
I don't know. Maybe I'll graduate school, maybe travel for a while. Try and figure out what I want to do with the rest of my life.
Do you remember when we were 12?
Summer I taught you how to sail.
Summer before that, what you told your mom.
That we were going to get married when we grew up.
I guess some dreams don't die.
It's the wrong dream, Mike.
You're right.
Yeah, the real dream is to kill you by any means necessary. Like, I guess that doesn't, I guess that is one aspect of it that the timeline doesn't totally hold. I mean, I'm sure
you
can explain. It seems like he's trying to see if she is still interested in him, but according to the film, the plan has already been set in motion like weeks before, so.
Yeah. I mean, I just thought that he was, like, it would be easier if he could just marry her. That would cut out a lot of problems. But, you know, if she's not interested, this is his backup, I thought.
Yeah, okay. That also works. Look, I want this to work. I want this plot to lock together like a Rubik's Cube.
I think it does.
I think it does, too.
So Olivia's big problem at the moment is her mother has just died, as we said, leaving her a shitty gold-digging stepfather named Tony Gateworth. He is played with gusto by John Glover. The joy he brings to the shithead and his dumb Caesar haircut is just a delight.
Yes.
I mean, really.
Just the, like, gloriously smug, I'm like a bedbug, you'll never get me out of here. Like, drinking hard liquor at 10:15 a.m., staggering, drunk, dickhead wastrel.
Yeah.
So good.
Walking around in a Speedo, just being the worst. So the slurs he calls Tim, once Olivia and Tim start seeing each other, spoiler, he calls him white trash and boat N-word twice. The first time I thought I misheard it, I thought he said boat rigor.
Rigor, yes.
He did not at all. No.
No, and he says it a couple more times just to make sure that we know that he's a cunt. Like, but we got it.
Yeah. He also has a girlfriend already, played by Dani Delany, Doug Savant's future Desperate Housewives co-star. Her name is Anne Briscoe. Chick Wolf.
With an E on the end.
Yep.
And she's wearing a Guess miniskirt. Listen to Sassy Is Everywhere.
Mm-hmm. So then we get to the first plot twist, which is Tony and Tim are in cahoots. The scam is Tim marries Olivia and then kills her. And then he and Tony split the estate.
Right.
That's a scam. You're a crime expert, Sarah. As scams go, what did you think of this one at this point in the story?
At this point in the story, it was like narratively interesting, but, you know, this kind of scam never works because whoever is supposed to hand over half the money never does it. Right. So also there's the matter of the getting away with the murder, which as it turns out, people are not that good at, which is why we have 78,000 seasons of Dateline.
Right.
Hashtag just get a divorce.
Right. So in order to convince Olivia that Tim is the guy for her, they're going to stage a confrontation between Tony and Tim where Tony comes in with a gun and he threatens him and Tim disarms him. And then Olivia will think he's an alpha. I can trust him and I can marry him. But when this actually the time comes for this to happen, something gets screwed up and or Tim, you know, takes matters into his own hands because Tony gets fatally shot instead.
Yeah.
Then basically he lets her talk him into leaving. And she says she'll just say he broke in. He was drunk. He tried to rape me. I had his gun. And so I shot him. And he, you know, it seems like they've covered pretty much everything. He goes back to see Brooke, the Kim Cattrall character, and he's like resetting the clock on her nightstand so that she thinks it's earlier than it is when he's getting
and
back.
And can alibi him. Right.
So that she can alibi him. Exactly. And then Mike shows up. He's the one to take Olivia's statement. He puts the story over by removing two wine glasses from her bedroom before the detective gets there. What a good friend.
Mm, definitely.
He just doesn't want her to get in trouble. So Olivia is not getting charged. It seems like the Hamptons cops are like, we don't want this publicity for this rich non-townie.
Well, yeah, like, you know, we don't charge non-poor people here in the Hamptons. Right. Move on. Yeah.
Also, no one liked Tony anyway, so it's like, whatever. Like, the only person
there was
who's
sort of, did this crime have a victim? Yeah, five
exactly.
to their comments.
Yeah. But then Anne, the girlfriend, can't shut up about Olivia's sketchy boat boyfriend. So it's pretty convenient when she hangs herself in her bathroom, leaving a typed unsigned suicide note. But Mike,
which is found performatively found suspicious by Mike.
Well, yes, he even though his chief tells him to drop it. He's a townie and he knows how shit is. So, you know, there's no point getting into this. But around that time, Olivia proposes marriage and she and Tim have a very quiet, quickie courthouse wedding. So then Tim's boss wants him to go to Florida to race his boat for the winter. And Olivia is about it. Clip 3.
How would you like to go to Florida next month?
Obsession sailing better.
Unbelievable.
And Mr. Morrison wants you to do the Southern racing circuit.
He knows we can win big.
I have no objections.
You don't?
Mm-mm. I think it would be quite pleasant being pregnant in Florida.
Ugh, you do? Seems like the worst place to get pregnant.
Yeah.
To be pregnant.
You also sound like you're having an allergy attack, so I guess it doesn't really matter where you go, but maybe someplace dry?
Yeah, perhaps. So Tim seems kind of dismayed about this news at first, but then he gets on board. But then he goes back from New York, where they were on Fifth Avenue or whatever, to the Hamptons to Mike's dad's office and meets with Mike because they were in cahoots as well. Double cahoots. I did not see this coming.
I did not see that coming either.
Yeah. So
that's where I was like, that's where I paused it and like basically made a crazy wall on my notebook. I was like, but, and then the carry the two. Yep, it works.
So Tim doesn't want to kill Olivia now because of the pregnancy. But Mike is like, you're gonna, because I have this wine glass from this crime scene with your prints on it. And I will conveniently find it if you don't play ball. And the way they play this scene, I swear to God, even though I know it was 1988, I kept waiting for the, like, a further reveal, which was that they were fucking. Because
I mean, yeah, because the way it was blocked, it did seem like that could have happened at any moment. And I think they did a good job just sort of like still holding something back. Part of this is that Rob Lowe, for someone that carved looking, is pretty good at his job as an actor.
Yes.
But he does have a certain had a certain impassivity, let's say. At times that I think served him and the script really well.
Yeah.
Because even in this scene, the way he's talking about Olivia and she's like, you know, once the kid comes, we're both cut off.
Right.
Like that it's still pretty cold. And I thought the script did a very good job throughout with him and with everyone else, just sort of like letting them kind of play it both ways enough that when you go back and cross check it, it can still work no matter how they play it. So
yes. Even so, I mean, I still thought the two of them were playing it like there was a draft of the script that they read where that was in it and it got cut because it's 1988 and we can't have bisexuality on screen. You know what I mean? Because it would make sense for that to be like the ultimate payoff.
Yeah.
Or that, you know, the, as it were, not just for me, I mean, for them too, like that, that was the what motivated this scheme in the first place.
Yeah. That they can then just like buy a lesser Florida key and live there as husband and husband. And
right. Or not like just, you know, backbite each other the whole time, like be scheming against each other to like steal it from.
Oh my God.
Whoever's
there could
survive.
Have been so many sequels to this franchise, truly, but.
Yes. But
for
like,
reasons that will become evident, it is not to be.
No, sadly. But like, Doug Savant grabs Rob Lowe by the hair. They are like inches apart. I was watching it, I was like, kiss! it's hot.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I really thought maybe that was going to be at least maybe Mike's angle now that he's like, okay, well. Like you're screwing me two ways now. Like,
right.
You weren't supposed to fall in love with her.
Right. Exactly. Anyway, the end of the scene is we zoom in on the wall at Mike's dad's office to a newspaper clipping of Mike, Tim and Tony all together after having won some boat race on the Southern Circuit. And I feel like in a David Mamet movie, we wouldn't have seen that until the very end.
Right.
Like, not until Olivia sees it would we know that it exists. Because, like, okay, well, we don't need this backup. Like, we know. We know about the cahooting. But whatever. Yeah. Anyway, Mike tries to arrange for Tim to kill Olivia in his car by jamming her seatbelt so she can't wear it. But Tim doesn't. And he goes to see Mike the next day. And he's all shirtless in his tidy whities. Mike is. And once again, seems like they're going to do some gay shit. But they don't.
Yeah.
And Tim's argument there is like, I couldn't do it then because I might also kill myself, which is like, okay, fair. Like, that makes sense.
Yeah.
But since Tim did not kill Olivia in the car, now he has to kill her on her dad's beloved boat, the Masquerade, with a propane leak or something, something. Who cares? Sidebar. Yeah. Can we agree?
Sailing.
Exactly. Can we agree? Nothing is more fucking boring than yacht racing. Like, who cares?
I mean, look, the credit sequence, except for like all these glorious Easter eggs that you get, like written by Dick Wolf.
Right.
But yeah, like, I think it is supposed to be like really compelling, but it's also like credits. Like, this is what you used to have to sit through.
Yeah.
No one cares. It's like coming about. Like, I get it.
Boats have motors. Let's get with it.
I also saw Wind in the theater, so
okay.
I'm not above this kind of thing when sure. certain people are in it. His names rhyme with Fletheu Floating.
Speaking of people who are like stars of the 80s who are keeping it tight in the 2020s, that guy.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Even that crazy wig in the college admissions thing, I was like, I still would. You could just put it on a lamp. I'll work with it.
So sometime around this point, Brooke tells Olivia that she was Tim's alibi the night of the murder. And since Tim had told Olivia he was fucking Brooke, but that it ended the night he met Olivia, this is upsetting to her. Fortunately, Tim has an explanation. Clip 4.
Is it true?
Olivia, for Christ's sakes, of course it's not true.
You said it was over by then.
It was.
Are you sure?
Olivia, think. She told you a time, 11:30. But you know where I was at 11:30. I can do a lot of things, but I can't be in two beds at the same time.
If Rob Lowe had a superpower, that would be it.
Yeah, pretty sure. One cheek in one place, one cheek in the other.
Could duplicate himself.
In touch by his, low tuplicity.
Yes. Anyway, Tim and Olivia are getting ready to sail off to Florida. Mike lets himself into the house and hides a file in, like, Tim's fucking sweaters. So then there's a lot of quick cutting at the end where we see Olivia getting groceries at the Barefoot Contessa.
Love that detail. Yes,
so good.
Me too.
But he figures out that he finds the file. He figures out what Mike did. And so he hurries. He hauls ass to the boat. He goes on. He stops whatever propane leak was happening. But then the rat that Mike also planted on board to sell the a rat chewed through the hose thing, like, crawls on his hand and he falls and he flips a switch and he explodes. He explodes real good.
Mm-hmm.
And Olivia sees it. So then she's in
Mike. I forgot that twist, too. I mean, yeah, justice for that stunt rat, by the way. Poor Templeton just kept looking at the camera like, really? How many crosses are there going to be?
Yeah. So she's
Where's my Kahoot?
She's collecting herself in Mike's dad's office when she sees the clipping on the wall. And again, as I said, this is like one of the, other than the casting of Meg Tilly, I feel like that should have been the first time we saw it, the clipping.
I disagree. I mean, I have my issues with the clipping. I do feel like the way it was placed, like, in order for us or anyone else to see it, they had to, like, the first time we see it, I feel like it's more realistically sort of like snowed under a bunch of other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But then the next time we see it and like, oh, like now that map has moved a little bit and it's right at eye level. Like,
yeah.
I mean, I'm sure this was a conversation that was had endlessly, repeatedly by the production. And I think where they came out was the only place they could come out.
Sure.
With it. But on the other hand, like, do we, I just am not sure that we even need it.
Yeah.
At all.
Right. Well,
yeah. Anyway.
So anyway, she sees it. Then Mike comes in and sees her seeing it. There's a struggle. She pushes him out the window, and it's not a very long fall, but he falls onto like a little decorative, you know, stone thing. And Sarah's laughing because the face they have him make in death is hilarious.
Oh my
God. It's really good.
If anyone's ever seen Hitchcock's Frenzy, don't. But if you have, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Like the post-strangulation death scenes with the victim's tongues look like dicks. Like, it's just, and it's not supposed to be funny. It's Hitchcock. And yet you're like, that looks like a dick.
Mm-hmm.
A gummy penis that someone put in this poor actor's mouth. Why is this happening? He also, his legs, like, it's just like this Gumby. You think you're watching a Savage Steve Holland production. It's just very weird. And it also was, for some reason, really difficult to screen cap. But I persisted.
Oh, thank God. Thank God.
Yeah.
So then it's the
tattoo time.
So then it's Tim's sparsely attended funeral where Olivia's lawyer tells her this. Clip 5.
Tim came to see me 2 weeks ago.
Why? What about?
To have himself taken out of your will. He made me swear that I wouldn't tell you. But now, with what's come out, you have to know. I think somehow he wanted to have all temptations removed. I tried to dissuade him, told him it was against your wishes, but he was adamant. He wanted nothing from you. He loved you, Olivia. However it started, he came to love you.
Shot of the sea.
Yeah. And she, like, smiles. I feel like hearing that, she should be sobbing. Like, that makes it so much sadder than he's dead.
Yeah, it makes it so much worse.
Yeah.
Also, that's not how willing works.
Yeah.
Lawyer, 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 lawyer. Guys, come on. Come on. If you could just take yourself in and out of wills, why wouldn't you have just rewritten it so the baby didn't get everything and saved everybody a shitload of trouble?
Yeah.
Not how it works.
But other than the casting of Meg Tilly, the timing of the clipping, which we disagree about, and the flagrant lack of gay stuff between Tim and Mike, a perfect movie.
And I actually don't think Meg Tilly is a problem. Because you're not really rooting for her, and I don't think you're supposed to be. So
yeah, that's true.
That you're sort of like, well, if they succeed in killing her, I'm not going to be that bummed out. I will say that the set two between her and Mike at the end, like, I know I was laughing at Savage Steve Gumby's demise. Mm-hmm. And we will tweet this from the account. It is, I mean, utter commitment. Well done, Doug Savant. But that fight is horrible to watch, like, really quite convincingly scrappy, and he, like, shoves her into a desk, like, uterus first, which I am sure was purposeful, and it's harsh, and she gets some pretty good licks in, and they don't let it go on too long. They don't, like, fetishize it. She just is sort of, and then finally she's just like, fuck you, you crazy fuck.
Yeah.
Shoves him out the window. I think he did most of the stunt that we see.
Yeah.
Because I've spent so much time trying to screen cap the aftermath that I really spent a lot of time with this, all this sugar glass and screaming. But yeah, I mean, this movie is like, it's not just 100 times better than it has a right to be. It's like legit good. Now, I was expecting something like Bad Influence, which is like, this is enjoyable, but it's like eating an entire case of Pringles. Like, I feel very weird and yet satisfied. I don't need to do that again for a while.
Right.
I wonder if we can find a way to, like, just cram various Rob Lowe properties sideways into again with this. But yeah, this is really efficient, tightly plotted, mostly good performances, and the performance that is annoying, I think, is in the service of the film.
That's
and
fair.
Rob Lowe's ass, since it can be in two places at once, one of those places should be the Smithsonian. I'm not a crackpot.
I think you have your next Quaid and Full-esque podcast after it's done, like the Rob Lowdown or something.
Uh-huh. Mm. Sweet and low. I'd do it again.